Welcome to Woke History. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I'm a college history professor in Washington, D.C. Woke History is a new podcast series that features lively conversations with guests focusing on historical and contemporary issues of race, gender, political activism, and culture that are often ignored in most high school classrooms and social studies textbooks. Guests will include a wide range of individuals from scholars and community activists to professional athletes, media personalities, and others. Let's begin our conversation. Our guest today is Dr. David Silberman. Professor, thank you so much for joining me.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you are teaching at one of my alma maters, George Washington University. I had a chance to attend GW, as we call it, some years back when I was working on my master's. Our paths never crossed, but again, this is a big honor to have you here. So how long have you been teaching at GW?
Since 2003. It's been a good long time.
And as a young boy, did you grow up dreaming of being a professor and having an illustrious career in academia?
Well, my first dream was to be point guard for the Boston Celtics, and my height didn't work out.
Okay.
My next dream was to be a rock musician, and well, my dad talked me out of that one. being a professor was a pretty good third option, and it proved to be the right move.
So you said being a point guard for the Boston Celtics, just so you know, I'm a big sports junkie. Are you from the Boston area, or was that just your favorite team growing up?
Yeah, I grew up just outside of Boston, so I'm a Boston sports junkie.
So tell me this, how did you fall in love with history?
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts, which is a very historically minded kind of place and has a lot of really compelling museums and monuments and sites. And you know, I was fortunate enough that my folks took me to those places regularly. Didn't mean that I was going to find those places interesting, but as it turned out, I did. Mm-hmm. I gravitated towards history courses in college. I was an undergraduate at Rutgers in New Jersey. And I was fortunate just to have an array of first-rate professors, particularly professors in the field of colonial American, revolutionary American, and Native American history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they approached these topics from a variety of different backgrounds. But what they had in common was an approach to history, as we call it, from the bottom up. Mm. You know, the histories of dispossessed people, of working people, of oppressed people, rather than the histories of elites, of politically powerful or economically powerful elites. And I found that angle on history to be really compelling, more than a little bit subversive, and something that I wanted to pour my time into.
There's this belief right now that students, they shouldn't major in history anymore, that there are no jobs in history compared to the STEM field. And, you know, that history is becoming somewhat obsolete. You know, we pull it out when we need it, if it's some crisis, and then we know we need to have some historical reference for it. But otherwise, it's not needed anymore. What do you say to those folks who have that opinion about our craft, our discipline?
Well, let's talk first about the civic role that history plays, and then we can talk about the practicality of the history major. Truth is being questioned from various segments of society. I mean, you know, obviously, Donald Trump is not alone in trying to challenge our collective understanding of truth. And so I think history plays a particularly valuable role in society right now, because at base, what we aim to be is truth tellers. Doesn't mean we always succeed, but that is our basic goal. We are trying to read evidence as accurately as we can and to craft narratives that will hold up to scrutiny based on those appeals to evidence, as part of our basic methodology. And I think training young people to evaluate evidence, to argue about evidence, and to try to come up with compelling analysis of that evidence is especially valuable at this particular moment in time in which so many people seem to think that truth is just a matter of perspective. Now, in terms of jobs, look, we train people not only to evaluate evidence, but to present their ideas in writing, you know, to synthesize large amounts of material, and to share their ideas in a compelling and accessible way. Those are skills that are applicable to practically any professional career that one would pursue. And so, obviously there aren't a lot of academic history jobs right now, but there are a lot of transferable skills that you develop as a history major that I think we should want to promote and that will be rewarded in the economy.
And so you were saying when you fell in love with history, it's because of, you know, the way they taught you the history, right? How it wasn't just focused on the elites. And I know that you talked about Native American history. What was it about the Native American story that really appealed to you?
Well, yeah, I had an interest in colonial American history from the start. And what I came to realize, I mean, there are a lot of undertold histories that deserve to be told in colonial America, to be sure. But no story is more deserving to be told and told less often and less well than that of the first people, the indigenous people. And you know, one of the things I always emphasize to my students is that Native people were most of the people in colonial America. We often forget that. They were overwhelmingly the majority of people in North America throughout the 17th and the 18th centuries. What's more, they controlled most of the continent well into the mid 1800s. And so Native people aren't some kind of eccentric side note to colonial American history. They're right at the very middle of colonial American history. And as we've learned more about the subject of Native American history over the past few decades, we've only learned that they were more important than we ever imagined to begin with.
So you've published a number of books, and your most recent one, This Land Is Their Land, which provides a much different account of the Thanksgiving holiday from what most of us were taught growing up in elementary school. Before we get into the book, however, I want to play a short video clip for you and for our listening audience.
Are we going to have a prayer? It's Thanksgiving, you know. Before we're served, shouldn't we say grace?
Year 1621, the Pilgrims held their first Thanksgiving feast. They invited the great Indian chief, Massasoit, who brought 90 of his brave Indians and a great abundance of food. Governor William Bradford and Captain Miles Standish were honored guests. Elder William Brewster, who was a minister, said a prayer that went something like this. We thank God for our homes and our food and our safety in a new land. We thank God for the opportunity to create a new world with freedom and justice.
Amen.
So what you were just listening to was a clip from one of many Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving specials, because I know they have multiple ones, but usually every year CBS or ABC will show these during the Thanksgiving holiday in prime time. So in that particular clip, the Charlie Brown and the gang were having their Thanksgiving meal, and they were reflecting on the first Thanksgiving, and you heard the beloved character Linus, the one who always has the blanket, reading the story of the first Thanksgiving, right? Very, very tender. And then they say, Lucy says amen at the end of the story. Very, very tender, okay. But Professor, you say in your book that this Thanksgiving story, this original Thanksgiving story, is more myth than reality. Why is that the case?
Well, you know, you heard in the clip that the whole point of this exercise of pilgrims and Native people getting together, right, was to establish a new world of freedom and justice. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the world that colonists created was not a world of freedom of justice for indigenous people, or for West African people, or for an awful lot of people. And you know, I think if you ask any reasonable adult, and of course, some adults are not reasonable, but you know, my experience has been if you ask any reasonable adult and you say to them, you know, do you really think a shared dinner should be the symbol of colonial Native American relations? Almost to a person, they'll say, no. And then I usually follow up with the question, then why do we keep propagating this story, teaching our children this patent falsehood? And the whole point of the book is twofold. One is to hold up the myth of the first Thanksgiving, of Native people making friends with colonists and then bloodlessly granting their country to these newcomers so these newcomers can create the United States as a beacon of Christianity and religious freedom and opportunity. And the second point of the book is to ask readers to reflect on the role this myth has played over the centuries in our society. Because the myth is a lie. It does not reflect the actual history of the first Thanksgiving, and it certainly ignores what followed after dessert was served. So that's important, but then asking people to think about why do we willfully distort this history generation after generation, I think is important to think about.
We focus so much with Thanksgiving on the dinner and this turkey feast. How did that become such an important part of Thanksgiving and how we remember that time period, the dinner?
Well, let me emphasize, one of the misconceptions that I think Americans have is that there was a real dinner.
Okay.
There was a real event in which the English of Plymouth Colony and the Wampanoag people, led by their sachem or chief, Massasoit, Massasoit's his title. It's like calling him Mr. President. Mm-hmm. His actual name was Usamequin. But that was an actual event. No question about it. But I think there's this misconception that after that event, all subsequent Thanksgivings held in colonial America extended from that precedent, that first Thanksgiving set the template and then future generations followed it. In fact, Thanksgiving was part of New England tradition and indeed English tradition more generally. I should also note that Wampanoag people, like people all over the globe, also celebrated Thanksgivings of their own, you know, after harvests or the end of a drought or, you know, what have you, right? This is kind of a universal human ritual. But, you know, the Thanksgiving that we think of as a nation was generated by New England. For the better part of two centuries, so throughout the 1600s, throughout the 1700s, and well into the 1800s, white New Englanders celebrated Thanksgiving without any reference whatsoever to Pilgrims and Indians and this harvest feast of 1621. No reference to it whatsoever. That association didn't actually begin until the mid-1800s, when the Reverend Alexander Young published the primary source account of this feast, and he added a footnote to it. And, you know, you're a historian like me, and you know, there aren't many influential footnotes in history, right? Well, this is one of them. He attached this footnote to, and it's only a two paragraph account of, you know, the English have brought in their harvest, they're ready to celebrate, the Wampanoag show up unexpectedly, they celebrate together. Alexander Young added a footnote to this account in which he said, this was the first Thanksgiving, the great harvest festival of New England. And so it's with that moment in 1841 that the seed is planted that, oh, the 1621 event was the first Thanksgiving. And readers of this account ran with it. And eventually it became became taken as general knowledge, as the truth, and became perpetrated in schools and popular culture until we got to the place where we are now, where everyone assumes that the first Thanksgiving set the precedent and the holiday and the history marched hand in hand from that point. It's not true.
And in the book, you really go deep into this story of how the myth gets spread. And I know you touched on, and hopefully you can discuss this, right? So you touch on the role that Reconstruction and Lincoln's desire to bring to reunify the nation after the war plays into this. You also touch on immigration, and then there's the topic of Indian wars, such as the King Philip's War. How do all of those different things tie into Thanksgiving as, you know, as we know it today, in this myth being spread over the generations?
Right. So, you know, Thanksgiving was a regional holiday until the Civil War, widely considered a Yankee holiday. Well, you know, the Yankees controlled the government during the Civil War and had Lincoln's ear and convinced him to declare Thanksgiving as a national holiday. So it begins in 1863 as a national holiday rather than just a New England one or a Northern one more generally. And the question becomes then, you know, how the myth of pilgrims and Indians got attached to the holiday and how it became resonant at that particular moment in American history. And I see a number of different issues at play. Culture wars were part of American society then as they are now. It's not just a recent historical development. And the culture wars of the mid to late 1800s centered on immigration, much as they do now. But the concern then was that for white Protestants in the United States, they, particularly in the Northeast, they were deeply fearful that they were being overrun by Catholic immigrants. You know, nowadays, I think we can fail to appreciate how intense Protestant bigotry towards Catholics was throughout the centuries, and certainly in the 1800s. So there was deep concern among white Protestants in the North that their cities and states were being overrun by Catholics, primarily from Ireland and Germany. And later, other religious other immigrants started to arrive too, Jews from Eastern Europe and Orthodox Christians from Central and Eastern Europe. And so this myth was appealing to them to white Protestants from the North in no small part because it turned their ancestors, New England Puritans, or in the particular case of Plymouth, New England Pilgrims, into founding fathers. And it made them the progenitors of American freedom of conscience, or, you know, religious freedom as we often refer to it. And democracy, right? They in the Thanksgiving myth holds up the Mayflower Compact, this agreement to abide by majority rule signed by the Mayflower passengers. It holds that up as the prototype for the Constitution. And it holds up their family migration to Plymouth Colony as the colonial norm. Now, anyone who studies colonial history knows most colonies were not settled by nuclear families. Most colonies were populated predominantly by indentured servants who are, you know, bound laborers, and they're young. They're mostly of college age and they're overwhelmingly male. They're really unruly, you know, like males of that age. And, you know, it's not a family story. There are other aspects of American society that weighed on this decision to embrace the Thanksgiving myth as well. You know, Reconstruction is certainly part of it. You know, American society was rent with division. In white American society was rent with division over Reconstruction policy after the Civil War. You know, the question of how many resources, how many troops, you know, how much money was the rest of the country going to devote to protecting Black freedom and justice in the South? And that was the main issue in presidential elections and senatorial elections and the like. One of the things that the the Thanksgiving myth allowed white Northerners to do is to treat the Negro problem, as they called it at that time, as a Southern exception to the main thrust of American history, as defined by the Plymouth, the Plymouth Colony story, which was about freedom and opportunity and justice. What's more, the country was also, you think we live in troubled times? The 1860s and 70s were troubled times. The country was in the midst of, you know, what nowadays we characterize as genocidal wars against indigenous people on the Great Plains and in the far west. And New Englanders were widely opposed to the violence, even as they benefited from it, and wanted to distance their ancestors from the pattern, the national pattern of colonial Indian violence. And so the idea of a shared meal is the symbol of colonialism, which doesn't address whatsoever the fact that this relationship between the Wampanoags and the English degenerated into bloodshed, like native colonial relations almost everywhere else, allowed them to accomplish this. So, just to tie up this conversation, what we see here is that the Thanksgiving myth gains purchase among white Protestants because it allows them to assert their cultural authority against Catholic immigrants. It allows them to assert their regional authority against the South and West. It allows them to distance themselves from the Black and Indian problems of other regions of the United States. And overall, it allows them to whitewash the bloody history of colonialism.
With these myths, right, a lot of times we learn them as children in elementary school. And I've heard people say, well, it's okay to teach the kids the myth of Columbus, of Washington and Jefferson, of Thanksgiving, as long as you correct it by the time they reach high school age, so that they don't go into college. What do you say to that? Is it okay from a young age to be spreading these myths to the kids, or are you doing damage?
I think you're doing damage, and you're doing damage in a couple of different ways. Let's focus on the most obvious way, and that's the damage done to indigenous people in the classroom. Too often, non-Native Americans are utterly dismissive of the experiences of their indigenous countrymen and women. Let me emphasize that point. Their indigenous countrymen and women. Native Americans are part of the United States. They are United States citizens. And the reason I wrote this book I have a relationship with Wampanoag people that's decades old. And they told me repeatedly over the course of these conversations throughout the years of how hurtful Thanksgiving season was to them every year, particularly when they were kids or if they're parents and they have kids. And the reason is, like so many of us, depending on our background, they would sit there in school and they had authority figures, history teachers, social study teachers, propagating lessons that they knew were lies. They knew their ancestors weren't just friendly people who welcomed the English and granted their country to them. They knew this wasn't a story of the two parties marching hand in hand in friendship through the ages. They knew that when their teachers would say, when kids would inevitably ask, well, what happened to these Indians? And the teachers would say, oh, well, they're all gone. They knew because they were sitting there that was a lie. Yeah. And they knew that just attributing their diminishment to a natural process of disappearance was a lie, right? That sanitized a really difficult and upsetting history. And so, it's a terrible experience for children of any background to come out of school thinking that these authority figures that they look up to have been lying to them. And so, so many, you don't have to be Native to have that experience. I think lots of different people in American society have that experience in history classes. But for Native people, it's particularly hurtful and particularly poignant. But it also does damage to everyone else. And I think particularly to white kids, because it in sanitizing the bloodiness of history, of colonial history, it doesn't allow them to understand where their privilege comes from. It doesn't allow them to think critically about this country's origins. And in turn, it handicaps them from thinking critically about our present and our future. If we're going to create a more just pluralistic society, we need pluralistic histories that A, tell the truth, and that B, allow everyone in American history to see themselves in that story, treated in a three-dimensional way. And I'm not advocating that we should teach grade school kids a history of Plymouth Wampanoag relations that involves epidemic disease and large-scale warfare and the desecration of the right. dead. And, you know, I don't want a horror show.
Yeah.
And you know, let me be clear. Colonial American history is just one long trigger warning.
Yeah.
I mean, every aspect of it is utterly brutal. You will see human beings of every description acting in ways that horrify us. That's what colonial history is. I'm not advocating that. However, we shouldn't be propagating a fairy tale when we teach colonial history. You can teach children, grade school children, that Native people were here first, that the land was theirs, and that they had no intention of granting their country or their independence to colonists from Europe. And that they fought against that fate. We don't have to teach all of the brutality of the slave system to grade school children, but we can still acknowledge that slavery was part and parcel of colonial America, and that it was wrong, and that people suffered under it and here too resisted it.
So Dr. Silverman, what do you do for the Thanksgiving holiday? Do you celebrate it with your family the way you know a number of Americans do, or is it hard for you knowing the real story of Thanksgiving?
It's not hard, and okay. Here's why. And by the way, you know, I take my lead here from many Wampanoag people. Who could be opposed to the idea of getting together with family and friends? That is when COVID isn't raging.
Yeah.
But who could be opposed to getting together with family and friends to offer thanks for what's good in our lives? That's a lovely ritual. We should do it more often.
Yeah.
I take no issue with that. We don't have to attach that ritual to a false history. Remember, the holiday and the myth did not march hand in hand from 1621 onward. For more than two centuries, Americans celebrated Thanksgiving without evoking Pilgrims and Indians whatsoever. It's a fairly recent development. So what I say is this: if we're going to attach that history to the holiday, let's get the history straight. But we don't have to attach the history to the holiday.
You know, so one of the more popular traditions during Thanksgiving is football. You know, and as a native Washingtonian, I grew up a fan of the Redskins, had the Redskins hat for the wintertime and Redskins leash for my dog, grew up on the team. But the Redskins have been a source of controversy for many years because of their name and because of their logo. And one of the things that Daniel Snyder would used to say in the past was that, you know, the Redskin name and logo, it means honor. That Redskin is not a racial epithet the way the N-word would be, that you're honoring these people. And he would back that up by saying, well, we've conducted surveys and we've gone and we've spoken to various tribes to survey them on their feelings about the use of the name and the logo. And only a very small percentage had you know, anything to complain about. Everybody else, you know, approved of us using this name, right? So as we know, the name was finally changed. You had a number of sponsors who pulled out. You had a number of huge stores and companies who stopped selling Redskin paraphernalia. Then on top of that, you had, a rush to change anything that had some link to, an offensive past and racism after the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor deaths. And then you also had the sex scandal with the 15 women who filed the lawsuit against the team, which came out a few weeks after they changed the name. So, Professor, I really wanted to get your opinion about this whole controversy surrounding the Washington Redskins name and why they fought so long to change the name and the logo.
Well, I mean, obviously the fan base is attached to the name and the logo, and that's why they didn't want to change it. I think as a general principle, you don't use categories of modern human beings as sports monikers. It's one thing to call your team the Vikings. There aren't Vikings anymore. It's another thing to call yourselves the Cowboys. Well, I suppose there might be some Cowboys out there nowadays, but they're not as prominent as they once were. Calling a team the Indians or the Redskins or the Braves and caricaturing them, right, in your logos serves to do two things. One is that it relegates Native people to the past. It is in many ways reflective of the ideology of the ideology of Manifest Destiny, the idea that Native people were relics of the past, right? That the only authentic Native people were frozen in some kind of Stone Age existence, and so that modern Native people aren't authentic Native people, right? And it makes invisible those Native people today who are part of modern society, which is to say all Native people, right? Who shop at the supermarket and drive trucks and cars and live in framed houses and speak English and go to university and, whatever they live like the rest of us. Yeah. Those kinds of sports logos define Native American authenticity as part of some kind of mythical ancient past. It's also a way of non-Native people appropriating Native people as a symbol. The idea is that there's no Native people to object. And so this becomes yet another step in conquest. It's a way, now you not only, non-Native people not only possess Native land, they possess Native images. They could use them any way they wish. I think the fact that some Native people don't care one way or the other what the Washington football team is called is neither here nor there. Yeah. Quite a number of Native people do, and quite a number of non-Native people also take issue with it. So why not just call the team something that doesn't raise this kind of a fuss? Call them the Senators or the Presidents or whatever. It would make life that much easier. There's a whole range of options out there that don't cause this kind of stir, this utterly unnecessary stir. I don't get it.
NASCAR banned fans from purchasing and then also waving the Confederate flag at their events. Do you think that there needs to be a similar ban? Because I know at Florida State or FSU, the team name is the Seminoles, and the fans there will do the tomahawk chant throughout their games. And the Braves, they do that as well at the Braves games, the Atlanta Braves in baseball and the Cleveland Indians. Do we need to ban that as well to say, hey, this is offensive, guys. Let's not do this at our games any longer.
Yeah, I'd like to see the teams adopt. Yeah, I don't think this is a matter for government to get involved in. I'd like to see a lot of pressure from the population in general upward on these organizations to end these practices. Yeah. They caricature Native people, they misrepresent the Native past, and they make many Native people today uncomfortable and invisible to the larger public. It does a great deal of damage. This is not just innocent fun.
You know, when we talk systemic racism and equality, oftentimes in our present conversations, we focus on Black communities, Latinx communities, and we leave out the Native American, the indigenous people, a lot of times in those larger conversations within the media. But the question that I wanted to ask you, how are Native Americans, how are they still suffering outside of, you know, being caricatured and having, you know, being associated with this mythic past, how are they still suffering today from the effects of, you know, the past discrimination, exploitation, government actions like President Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act of 1830 or the, you know, the Carlisle Indian Border School? How are they still suffering, you know, now in 2020 going into 2021?
Where do we begin?
Okay.
So let's start with maybe not the most obvious answer, but I think it will be one that will be familiar to many of your African American listeners. Let's just think about the amount of wealth that white Americans have robbed from indigenous people across the generations. That if they had been, that if Native people had been in control of that wealth, would improve their lives immeasurably today. And that wealth has been stolen from them in the form of land, in terms of natural resources, and in terms of making it impossible for their communities to act collectively in their collective best interest. So there's the sunken costs that are that have been lost to them over the generations. Let's think about the ways that they are trying to restore aspects of their culture that have been robbed from them. Let me not frame that in the passive tense, because that gets white Americans off the hook. That white Americans have robbed from them, specifically their languages, right? The process of taking Native children from their families and sending them away to boarding schools generation after generation after generation destroyed many Native languages. And as you know, many of your listeners will identify with, when a group of people has its own language, that means something critical to their sense of identity, their sense of distinctiveness. So many Native people today are trying to revive their indigenous languages, and it's really hard, right? Because the face-to-face communities that sustain those languages don't function the way they used to, right? They're part of, Native people are part of a majority English language speaking society, and are fully integrated in it. Let's talk about the kinds of issues that have risen to the fore with the Black Lives Matter movement. Native people suffer from police violence more than any other group of people in American society. They suffer rates of suicide and substance abuse and sexual abuse and low education rates more than any other group in the country. Their per capita wealth is lower than any other group in the country. And so I think those statistics say it all. Yeah. And here I think it's important to note something. Native Americans are not just another minority within the United States. They were the first people, and as such, they have rights that are particular to that status. They have rights as tribal nations to sovereignty. That means the right to land as a group. That means the right to govern the group, to decide who's a member and who's not a member, and what that membership will mean. It means right to govern the natural resources within their territory. It means the right to determine their own cultural future and political future. And that's different than any other group within the United States, right? For most other groups within the United States, what they want is equality and justice within the United States. Native people want that too, but they also want their sovereignty. And that sovereignty is recognized by a history of treaties with the United States ratified by the Senate. Let's remember, under our Constitution, ratified treaties are the supreme law of the land. Doesn't mean the United States has recognized those treaties as the supreme law of the land, but they hold that status. And Native people are fighting every single day to get the United States to recognize the terms of these treaties, which were negotiated under unequal circumstances to begin with.
I mean, it's so sad. I was reading a copy of Andrew Jackson's 1830 letter to Congress, where he was talking about the reasons for the Indian removal. And Jackson, there was this, let me see, I think I have it handy. Yeah, here it is. So Jackson says, this is Andrew Jackson, ladies and gentlemen listening. He's talking about, how we're gonna remove them. And he says that it'll separate the Indians from immediate contact with settlements of whites, free them from the power of the states, enable them to pursue happiness in their own way, and under their own rude institutions, will retard the progress of decay, which is lessening their numbers, and perhaps cause them gradually, under the protection of the government and through the influence of good counsels, to cast off their savage habits and become an interesting, civilized, and Christian community. That's the precedent, ladies.
He wrote that at a time when Southeastern tribes like the Cherokees, the Creeks, and the Comanches were adopting Christianity in large numbers, in which they were promoting literacy education among their people in large numbers, in which they were publishing their own newspapers, in which Native males were taking up animal husbandry and the women were taking up the spinning of wool, in which some Native elites were forming cotton plantations with black slave labor, just like Andrew Jackson practiced, in which they had adopted their own written constitutions modeled on that of the United States. In other words, he was willfully lying to himself and the American people that Native people were incapable of change, that they necessarily, by divine will, deteriorated and went extinct through contact with white people. It was patent nonsense. It was a land grab and nothing more.
Professor, this has been a great conversation. Before I let you go, can you just tell our listeners where they could find your books, if you have a website where they could follow you? And lastly, what do you want listeners to really take from your research and your scholarship?
So I'm not on social media whatsoever. It's just how I get these books done. So if you're interested in purchasing This Land is Their Land, order it through your local independent bookstore. They need a lot of help, particularly during this pandemic. And don't do the lazy thing and order it through Amazon. Help your independent local merchants. And that's good service. What do I want people to get generally out of my work? One is I want them to see how central Native people have been to American history from its very beginning, and I would contend right up to the present moment. I want them to see Native people in that past in three-dimensional form, not as some kind of proto-ecologists or proto-hippies or some kind of noble savage to teach us in our wayward modern ways a better way of living. I want them to understand that these were complicated people with their own upsides and downsides, with their own power struggles, who were making their way in the world, and that tracing that history throughout the centuries is a way for us to also recognize our modern Native American countrymen and women as modern people who have passed through what I think we can only call an apocalypse and made it to the other side and aren't going anywhere. We as a society have light years to go to recognize how they passed through that apocalypse and to make them feel as they should, like they're fundamental parts of our society.
Well, once again, sir, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.